So the students, I assume, it's mandatory, you have to be here. I'm seeing some people that might be past the student years, so that's a real... Thank you.
Beg your pardon.
In the best way, past that young look that none of us want.
Well, great. So can you hear us without the mics, or is the mics okay? I mean...
I hope you can hear us without the mics.
Yeah, well, right, exactly. Yeah, so first of all, join me in thanking Paul and Leah for a great performance. The idea here is just really informal, so I'll start things off. I'll ask Paul and Leah some questions, and then we're just going to open it up after a bit and get some questions from you guys as well, okay? So I've got my little cheat sheet here. Paul and Leah, could you tell us what brought you to indeterminacy in the first place, and what especially brought you to indeterminacy and made it seem like it was something that you wanted to sort of play with and riff on?
What it was something you may or may not have seen a lot of tonight, oddly, but I really don't remember how it is that I started speaking. You know, in our theater company, that technique is used a lot where we put an earbud in your ear and whatever's got on your phone, you can speak it. It's very useful, like if you're working on a monologue, or, you know, we use it all kind of ways. Anyway, so I don't know when I started doing this thing of listening to the cage and moving to it, but I noticed that when I did little dances and little things, that there were, no matter how I rearranged the moves, there tended to be little connections between this or that move and what I was saying, and that intrigued me. So that sort of got the ball rolling. It took actually about a year to get to the point where I could dance that whole thing straight through, no matter what words I'm saying, you know, that particular juggling act. And I've always looked for something that I could just rehearse, you know, and sit with a theater company, you have to find a space, and there's other humans involved. It's, such a hassle. So this thing I could work on completely by myself, which was like, finally. You know, and I put in a lot of time doing it. Now, Leah, your relationship to Cage, I'd be very curious about, because Leah's a sound artist who's about to do some touring in Europe, and so I feel like Cage might be a kind of important figure. Is this true, or how?
Yeah, I mean, I guess when you speak of indeterminacy, you are talking about the juxtaposition of three different elements in the performance. There's sound, movement, and text, right? And so the three elements in this performance are presented simultaneously within the same kind of time-space continuum, right? But they are not so much about describing each other. They kind of just exist together. And this idea is actually something that was pioneered very much by Cunningham, Cage, David Tudor, and a lot of people from that era, is that the audience makes their own kind of visual conclusions about things when they're presented together. It's the same way where if you watch a film and you have a soundtrack happening at the same time, your brain draws these connections. So it's kind of almost like a cognitive thing that occurs. So you don't have to be so, pedantic in the way that you present these different elements together.
Right, so the music, so did that pre-exist? Does that music pre-exist in the form that we heard it tonight? Is that something you're doing on the go back there?
So it's, so what I'm doing is I'm basically collaging electronic sound sources. They're all pre-recorded tapes. It's basically like a structured improvisation.
Yeah.
It can never exist in the same exact way, but it does have like a predetermined structure that I'm kind of, an end sound palette that I'm kind of keeping with, but because of the nature of the medium, I can never be that exact with any of that stuff.
So you're being responsive to what Paul's doing, though, when you're...
No.
You're not?
No.
Okay, all right.
Nope.
All right.
Okay. And a lot of the sound sources are chosen in a more kind of I don't know, historical way. I was using some of Cage's voice. Mm-hmm. I was using some of Cage's prepared piano pieces and some other random bits of junk that I've recorded. Yeah, so, I mean, I'm really not looking at him while I'm performing.
Right, well, that's really essential to the piece, right? I mean, that's kind of, you know, the initial conception of the piece was, actually, I think the music and the performing was actually cordoned off from one another, right? You couldn't actually hear.
When Cage made these 90 stories and recorded them, they were part of a piece called Indeterminacy, which was a collaboration with this composer, David Tudor. So what he did is Tudor went into a separate recording studio and recorded, I guess, 90 minutes of music. And then they put the Tudor recording and the Cage speaking together on one track. And so they had never, Tudor hadn't heard the words and Cage hadn't heard the music, and they went together randomly.
Yeah, and I think that that kind of approach was a bit more rigorous in that indeterminacy idea. And I think probably because, you know, it was coming out of an era where things were very matched.
Yeah.
So they were kind of trying to deprogram their own impulses to work together in that kind of way.
Yeah, so that brings up another question, so for both of you, but I guess I'll start with Paul. So that's really a rigorously, minutely worked out series of things that you do there, and it must create a different kind of energy than sort of you're used to when you're performing. So what's it like on the go to experience that? Do you sort of, you say you feel that sometimes it locks in sync, sometimes it doesn't lock in sync. It seemed to me that sometimes the movements, when it was locking in sync, you kind of picked up on that, like a little bit later, and you made the movement a little bit sharper.
It's true. What it's like is, it's a challenge. It's a very Cagean kind of challenge. He was very interested in finding strategies where the performer had to be absolutely present in the room at this moment, as opposed to, say, a performance where you're drawing on, you know, memory or, anyway, without getting into the mishigas of it. What's my point? My point is that when I'm doing that, the movement and the words are happening simultaneously, but the challenge of the piece is, can I be aware enough and not doing anything sort of automatically? Aware enough so that when there's connections do happen, which they do periodically, I don't know how much happened this evening or not, it's different every night, that I don't milk the connections, but I'm aware of them. And I let them play. I think that's what you were picking up on, Fred.
Yeah.
Like if, you know, he raised his hands toward God. You know, if I happen to be doing that, I don't want to pretend that that movement doesn't relate to those words. I don't want to milk it and, like, act it or anything.
Right.
But I do want to let that image kind of resonate. So it's, for me as a performer, I'm just trying to be aware of these moments when these connections happen and let them live without sitting in them too much. So that's one aspect of what's happening. The other aspect is, what's next? What's next? Ah, fuck, what's next? Pardon my French. You know, that's another aspect of it.
Yeah, so that brings up another aspect of it. Leia,
which gets in between me and you, so it's like you're trying to say, what's next, what's next, what's next, but I'm still trying to be here in this room with you like we are right now. Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Leia was talking about sort of Cage breaking down something in order to maybe not rebuild it, but let it be in a certain other kind of way. So he was working, you know, sort of like a koan in essence, right, sort of breaking down something. And then allowing something to sort of emerge from it. So do you both feel both the breaking down part when you perform and the emergence part? So there's a kind of a little bit of strife in there as well, right? So you kind of have to live in both moments at the same time. Am I getting that right?
I mean, I find it to be kind of a magical process, this kind of like improvisational collage technique, because different sounds tend to emerge at different times. And as I said before, you know, you have to almost like cede control to some degree. I mean, obviously, like, I've done this a lot and I know how to control my here, but at one point you just kind of have to let the sounds do what they're going to do and try to manipulate them as best that you can on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
So this emergence that you're kind of speaking of, to me, is just like a very magical process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that came
but you know, with the question you mentioned, I think about, because I do meditation as well, and I think of a thing that's very similar. I don't know if any of you have engaged in that, but you know, there's the idea of you put your mind on some simple thing and then your mind, of course, drifts away, right? And the thing of the many things I think you want to not get too caught up in is, oh, it drifted away. Oh, that was bad. Oh, now I've been on the mantra for a long time. I'm doing really good. You know what I mean? That kind of judgment. By the same token, that relates to this in the sense of, wow, I've been talking and moving for a good while now, and there's no connection between the two whatsoever. I mean, there's no reason why that's not as interesting visually, artistically, as those times when those lovely, strange connections occur. And so I want to try to not judge, if this is what you were referring to, I want to not judge one as good and the other bad.
Yeah, it's just almost as if you want a kind of
happen.
Equilibrium, right?
Yeah, so. You want to let whatever
way it happens.
I mean,
you're kind of speaking
to
this interesting thing where if, focus and almost like a disciplined approach can open up the process to a greater freedom, actually.
Yeah.
If you're so focused on doing something that is a rote set of, actions, that the possibilities for different types of freedom to emerge within that
are increased.
Yeah,
you don't want those moments where it seems to us, the audience, that the action comes together with the words. You don't want that to sort of be the paradigm and then everything
Absolutely.
Else to be a deficiency.
Absolutely.
Right?
Exactly.
You have to have it sort of on a kind of plane.
Yeah, this is just...
I think that this piece kind of exists somewhere between that like rigorous indeterminacy of Cage and Cunningham
mm-hmm.
and something post that, where like the structure is determined and there are elements that we have cues that we follow,
sure,
but there is also that juxtaposition of like
it's not as pure and it's exact it's
yeah.
not pure as pure a version as of indeterminacy as the Cage.
So it's like taking that
original
idea, but then kind of like crafting it,
making
and sculpting
it, our own
it
a little
into something that has a little bit more,
authorial
intention behind it.
Yeah, maybe the idea is we've sort of moved through that Cage moment in its first sort of pass in
a way.
Yeah,
definitely. I mean, it's modernism, Like modernism is something that we've been past for how long? How many decades? So it's something that has already been explored. And that's why, indeterminacy, this concept was so crazy progressive at the time, was because it had never been explored. It was always about the composer controlling the situation or the choreographer controlling the situation. And that's why it was so radical at that time. But we really are in a different landscape now.
Yeah, so what do you think about the Brown piece in regard to indeterminacy? I mean, I took it that it was presented as a kind of friendly contrast.
I think you're right. I thought of it initially. I just saw someone I really love and who was in the company do that dance and always liked it. But I think you put it pretty well that I think Cage would be amused that I do something that's so contradictory mm-hmm. to what he was up to. So it was just a whim that, this song by the Grateful Dead is it's a song. So that music already is the way it's composed is not in his tradition. And the Trisha Brown movement. So I thought of it as a kind of addendum that's a kind of mm-hmm. playful contradiction
so
of what I do before. But then it has some historical connection, though, too.
Yeah,
just
sure.
She's
right.
In a certain moment of the, comes out of the Judson Church. And
exactly.
So they're a little bit connected historically, even though the dance at the end is kind of a contrast.
Yeah. So would you say that there's a different form of presence for you on stage with the Brown versus the Kizer?
Yeah, that's a great observation. Learning how to do that, because it's actually, you know, it's probably picked up on, it's one move, two moves, three, four, five, and it just keeps accumulating, thus the title. And it's very rigorous, it's tricky, it's hard to do. And so it is a different relationship to the audience. When I'm doing the cage speaking, the cage stuff, I really kind of in a funny way, I'm in a discourse with the audience. I feel like it's kind of a bit of a conversation, even though it's one-sided. Whereas with the Trisha Brown, that kind of performer, the performer that's connecting in that way has to go away, and you have to do this thing, and you have to do it in a self-contained way that stands apart from the music and apart from the audience. Not that I'm closed off from the audience, but I'm not in the same kind of discourse because the rigor of the piece won't allow that.
You think more kind of, well, I don't know how I would put it without seeming like it was isolating, but more inside the actual movement?
Just the movement. I'm just showing the choreography.
Yeah.
That's my job, to show the choreography, not to like live or radiate through it and connect to anyone. I'm showing the choreography.
So let me ask a last question, and then let's open it up here to each of you sort of individually. So, Leia, you're a composer. You compose music in sort of the, so to speak, absolute sense of music, which is to say it's not too movement and so on and so forth. How do you find this kind of a thing informing that kind of practice and vice versa? Do you see that as sort of two parallel things, or are they really interactive for you?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that the nature of what I do is necessarily informed by my environment at any given moment. So, of course, that, you know, in this kind of context, I'm going to sort of play sounds that I feel like are appropriate and that make sense for the work. A lot of my music is very like aesthetically challenging because it exists in a very abstract realm. I use noise a lot, an abstract sound. So it's actually very interesting more on like a social level performing in this context, because usually like as a solo performer, I play for people who are kind of already initiated into experimental music.
Yeah.
So in this kind of context, it's very interesting because a lot of times people just don't know what is happening.
Right.
Which is a good thing,
yeah,
you know, spread the good word, you know.
It is. And so sort of the similar question to you, Paul. So, Paul, you've acted in lots of films, lots of Hollywood films, as a matter of fact.
Not anymore, I'm too old.
Well, I don't know.
No use for me.
We'll find one. So that's really different. In a way. Well, see, this is what I'm going to ask you.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
So for you, are those two sort of parallel tracks, or do you bring something sort of from this into Snowpiercer,
Right. Yeah, there is one aspect of it that is, I think, related oddly, even though obviously the, you know, like a movie is behaving, the aspiration, as Sanford Meisner put it, to behave realistically under imaginary circumstances, which is not what this is. So the thing, though, that's present in, like, say, acting in a movie and doing this is being, I was telling these stories to you, and, you know, in a movie, let's say it's another character, and I'm talking to that character, I'm trying to have that be present in that same way. There may be added circumstances around it, and that's different, because we're not pretending anything. I'm in the room with you, and I'm not pretending otherwise.
Right.
But the thing of trying to speak honestly and connect and express a little bit, I think, more than Cage. Cage actually warned against this, and I feel like I'm a little bit... violating something that he at least initially wanted, was that he was like, don't act out these stories, which I don't really act them out, but I do, like, sometimes if the, you know, Zen monk says, come back, you know, I inhabit it a little bit,
sure,
or different, in different spots. So all that is an aspect that's in something as different as a movie.
See, what I thought you were going to say is this, mm-hmm. Okay? So I thought you were going to say, so what I was almost ready to hear was something like this. There's a kind of precision in what you're doing here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Minute, you know, nuance of movements and facial expressions, mm-hmm. you know, that are, in a way, sort of camera ready in a way.
But look,
you know,
there's a camera and yeah, everything.
And everything. So the idea would be that, you know, film picks up more than theater does, and so it would sort uh-huh. of play to that as well, that kind of almost minute ability for the camera to read face and
yeah.
to read gesture in a way.
You know, it's certainly possible. That yeah. might be an aspect of it that I'm almost not aware of when I'm doing it. You know what I mean? That you speak about, because certainly that eye is very scrupulous
yeah, yeah.
and very like a microscope.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I bet you that perhaps I'll just unconsciously, just because of the presence of that.
Yeah.
My mother was a photographer, so uh-huh. she took pictures uh-huh. She was a children's photographer.
Yeah.
Since I was little, there was uh-huh. a camera taking pictures, and so I think it became second nature, just a way of being in front of a lens, that so it may just be in my.
I had no idea.
Right? Yeah, yeah. It was, so it's more
that's
of
wild.
A, you know, unconscious adjustment that's happening.
Okay. Well, what I'm going to do now is I do have a mic here, and if you want to use mics, if you don't want to use mics, but it's basically open. I'll sort of travel the room.
Is the
with
idea
these.
Of the mic that is it's being recorded?
I don't know.
Oh, okay. That's I'd heard because
yes.
I thought.
Yeah.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
But
so
the recorder there is a pretty good one.
Oh, so they don't necessarily need.
Okay.
Exactly. Okay.
All right. Well, keep them on then. Okay, okay. Great. You can use it if you like. If not, that's fine.
So, first question for you, Professor Rush.
Sure.
Perhaps it's because you were the only faculty member available tonight, but perhaps this also has something to do with your work, your area of research, what you do at Notre Dame. So, if you could help us understand how what you do at Notre Dame and your research relates to this.
Wow.
And then for the two performers, mm-hmm. what's it like performing at an academic institution? What has been your experience here at Notre Dame as an academic institution versus other venues that you might perform?
Yeah.
Well, you want me to go first?
Yes.
Okay, great. Okay, so, well, I've been an active lover of what Paul and Annabee do for years, so it was great to get them here. So that was an antecedent interest and relationship. But relative to what I'm doing, I teach philosophy of art is part of what I do. I'm teaching a class now in philosophy of film. Hi, guys. You know, part of that I thought would be really interesting, which isn't really done philosophically at all, is to really talk about the aesthetics of performance, that is what it's like to make it, you know, and philosophers don't talk that much about that sort of thing. So the idea was, well, let's have some making it, right? And, you know, Cage was super concerned with, you know, what it is to have a performance, what it is to have a composition, what it is not to have a composition, what it is not to perform mm-hmm. in certain kinds of ways. He really thought these things through, and he thought these things through in terms of work that he made as well. And, you know, Big Dance Theater is really at the cutting edge of this kind of thing. So it was kind of a no-brainer to try to get him in here. So we're doing a unit now on this sort of thing, mostly with film things, but, you know, we stretched a little bit here with the theater. So that's sort of, you know, where I'm coming from. Yeah.
About performing in an academic setting. I'm trying to think if this is maybe the first time we've
done a performance
at a...
I mean, definitely at a school, for sure, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think there's a ton of variation between different universities as well, in that if we were in a setting where, you know, there are a lot of, say, these days, performance programs, where actually there's like a place like CalArts, you know, they're actually learning to make work in this sort of non-traditional kind of way, or it's a different tradition, maybe it's not non. And so that audience would be different than than this audience. And this audience, I think, so I can't speak that authoritatively since this has been one show. So I don't know. I don't know. I have to think a little more about it. It's certainly a different energy at university, but it's probably different in so many ways, depending on what part of the student body is seeing it, and all so many, you know, just as a general rule with performance, there's so many nuanced factors that go into what the energy of an audience is. You know, it's just bizarre, and how much it changes from night to night. And like, we're going to do this show here tomorrow night, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if it feels very different, you know. So it's a trickier question than you might think.
Yeah. I think I agree. It depends on the nature of the institution. I think that the facilities here are pretty excellent.
True.
So, you know, in terms of being able to realize the piece in the proper way, like having a legit lighting grid and having good sound, you know, that definitely speaks to the nature of the institution. So, I mean, the ability for an artist to realize a piece at its, you know, fullest potential mm-hmm. is something that's really important, and you definitely do need that kind of support. And not all institutions, unfortunately, are able to offer that. So, yay. good job.
Thank you.
Look, you got it. You don't need it? Well, they want to hear you on the tape, though.
Okay.
Now it's going to be really loud. just wondering if the choreography was made separate from the text, or if the text.
Great question.
Sort of
online. Yeah. The choreography is my wife, who's co-director of the company, named Anna B. Parson. And the choreography was very separate from the text. In fact, once I realized that I wanted to do this, and sort of conceptualized the piece, I went back to video of pieces of ours going back like 20 years and took dances all the way through our repertory. So there, most of the stuff was made prior. Most of the choreography was created prior to even being involved at the Cage Text. Then I ran out of material. And so then I asked Annie to make me more material. But even the new stuff is unrelated to the Cage Text.
It's almost like a greatest hits collection.
Yes.
So is there music to the dance?
Yeah, well, that's, you know, some of the dances have music to them when they were originally done. And there are certain of the dances that the movement, I remember, rather than remembering counts, I'm remembering the original music as a way to remember the movement. So that's parts of it, and a number of them have music to them in the original setting.
In this context, no, the music is not related to any of the movements or the text. Well, I guess maybe it's related to the text insofar as I'm collaging pieces of John Cage's voice and text. From this project together, but it's not related in an architectonic sense.
Yeah, that's a pretty actually dramatic moment when the cage is fading out and you're coming in right at the end, and you're speaking out what that was the one bit of it that looked really kind of pre-planned in a way, because mm-hmm. it had to be, but it had a real power to it.
Thank you.
It's kind of like pulling him out of history, you know.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool. Come on, don't be shy. Yeah, please, here you go.
Because of the unrelated nature of each of the aspects of it, when you're doing the performance and you have a moment where you hit a really sweet spot, when you come back after the performance and you're thinking about it, do you try to ever generate that feeling again? I'm not sure if I'm saying that correctly, but when you have things that are interrelated, you can think back on how that all worked together to create that moment. But when you have these disparate pieces, do you have moments where just a piece of it comes and you think, ooh, I can get back to that moment?
I think for me, it's always actually a little bit of a trap to do that. I mean, there's things that I think it's good to reflect and kind of like learn like what things work and what things don't work.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it is a bit of a trap to actually try to recreate anything in particular. Because then you're just sort of in the process of trying to do that, and it never actually really happens. So it's almost like an exercise in failure to even try to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not so much, I completely relate to what you're saying, because in doing a regular, more traditional performance, you're repeating everything from the night before, and there's a constant battle to not do last night's performance. You want to do it as present in, to tonight as possible. So I really relate to...
It almost takes you out of the moment.
Right.
To be like, oh, let me get back to that space.
In this particular piece, I don't have the problem so much because the language, the stories are coming up in random order, so it's pretty rare that a movement will relate in the same way on two different nights to the words. So I'm almost protected against that problem. But I think we both see it as a kind of a problem.
A problem.
Yeah,
okay.
But I mean, on the other hand, like, I do actually think that reflection is important, you know? And to, you know, think about something after you did it and say, okay, well, that was really working. That's interesting. But I think you can't be too, like, specific about it.
Ah, here we go.
Could you sing a little into the mic?
Sing?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't sing.
Oh, I just
to be honest, if you heard me sing, I'd have to apologize for every year. But my question for you is, how is practice sort of implemented into this? How do you practice for something that's really on the spot like this? Because it's all, in a way, it is randomized, so it doesn't feel like there's too much of a chance for preparation.
Well, I have to practice the movement score, because that's fixed, and that's the same every time. And I have to go through it even when I'm not having a performance coming up. I kind of have to go through it every few days. It takes about half an hour, because the movement score, if I start to forget it, it's such a hassle to go back to my notes and re-find it. So separate from the language, I have to practice the movement score, just mark through it pretty regularly. So there's always that to practice. And then the way I practice the language part of it is I'll put on different, I have a bunch of playlists from different performances that are all Cage, and I'll put them on shuffle and just do them in various random order when I do the, just basically kind of do what you saw tonight. So there's tons of opportunity for practice. The other thing practice-wise I do is we weren't so many tonight, but there's some, see, the thing was Cage was intent upon it being exactly a minute, every story. So when he tells a long, elaborate story, he has to talk very fast to make it exactly a minute. So some of them will come up that are killer fast, and I have to practice those just sitting in a chair just so I get it, you know, so down. Otherwise, the words will get away from me, and I won't be able to, you know, speak it. So that's the practice part. Yeah. There's a lot of it, particularly, you know, I'm not 21, so memory is different now. You know, I have to go over it like a rhinoceros learning a trick. You know, they take a lot of repetition.
As everyone knows.
Yeah, as you all know about rhinoceros training. Or don't they have a rhinoceros training program at Notre Dame?
Yes.
I have two questions. First off, when you start hearing the next story.
Sorry. I won't answer that now. But that was weird. I was just about to press go. Oh, that's my son. Sorry. Yes. You know, when I press go and Annie, my wife, sent me a text right at the moment that I was going to press shuffle and it like...
You gotta put on airplane mode.
I do, but then it won't... Will it do the...
Yeah.
Anyway, we can discuss this. Sorry. Yes, what were you going
to... So, once you hear the first couple words, you stop listening to the story
uh-huh.
and just say it the rest as you memorized it?
No, because I don't. For a couple reasons, I listen. Some of them, I'm sure I kind of 80% know all of them to an extent, but I've never made a real effort to memorize them because I like to have him say it and me repeat it as he says it. Because in his effort to make it exactly a minute, he puts spaces in the story, like shorter stories. Two monks came to a stream. One was Hindu, the other Zen. He has very specific spacing. So I like to do it in the same rhythm as he does it. So I don't do it from memory. I'm actually listening to him and repeating after him as he speaks. There are places where I'm speaking right with him. But.
And also, would you say that it's you might just answer this, but that your mind is more focused on the words in the moment and in the muscle memory?
Right. Wonderful question. I think it's like I need to do this with some electrodes on to find out exactly, but there's an ever-shifting balance. You know, like in certain moments where the movement's very simple, and there's certain things like when the advertising guy says, would you like to prostitute your art? And I said, yes. I really love that part, so I'm right there with that. And let's say it's happening while I'm just walking in a circle, then I'm much more present with the verbal part of it. Then if there's a wicked tricky part of movement, then I'm probably a little more focused on the movement. But it's a very good question, because if whatever comes up that puts my focus on the one, I have to be vigilant about serving the other. Because the thing that took months is, oh, here's a tricky part of the movement, and the words just don't become completely unexpressive. Because I'm just so focused on just getting through the moves that I can't be communicative with the words. So learning how to be sort of 100% communicative with both the language and the movement at the same time throughout, or, you know, that's the aspiration anyway. That's the challenge.
One more.
Yes.
Ah, great.
So, what happens when her music starts and you took the earbud out? How
yep.
does that, are you reacting to what track she plays and you know what you're saying?
Those last three stories?
Yeah.
Those last three stories are.
The monk one again.
Did we hear the monk twice?
It's a different one.
It's a different monk one.
Okay.
I cannot tell a lie. Oh boy, this is an elaborate story. But I'll tell it really precisely. I mean, quickly.
You have 1 minute.
Yes, right. The way we used to do this is, you know, QLab. It's a program where you can play different tracks on a computer. So we had a device, a mic, a wireless device, where if you whatever one we did, it would come up randomly. the person, the stage manager would, in back, would hit that track, hit a random track on QLab, and it would come into my ear. It was wireless, right? So the device that I had in my ear was not my phone. It was the, so that device I could put on in my ear and keep it in my ear throughout. Okay, so then I've been trying to simplify this so much. So I said, why not just use my phone and put it on shuffle? Which 90% of the, which works totally, except that when Leah comes up, I stop, I take my jacket off, and I take a sip of water. And when I take my jacket off, at least this was what I decided to do, I don't know, I don't want to fritz around with my phone. So when I take my jacket off, I got to take the earbud out, and the whole apparatus goes on the chair. So I memorized those three stories, and I always tell those three stories, okay? So that's not random.
But I guess that kind of speaks to what we were talking about earlier.
Yes,
in
right.
That, you know, it's a balance in between intentionality and lack of intentionality.
Right, because the last, very last story that I tell after Leah's played and played, and I say, the sounds are just sounds, that whole last story, that one I tell at the end every time because I feel that it, I have an intention there of, I feel that it encapsulizes something about what Cage is up to that I always like to end the show with. Oh, that last line of it actually is what I care about, which is if people learn to listen, they might discover that they prefer the sounds of everyday life to the ones they're about to hear in the musical program, and that was all right as far as I was concerned. I feel that one of the main things John Cage is up to is these elaborate strategies to get us to listen to the world, just listen to the world as it is in any given moment, even right now. I mean, his piece 433 is a pretty extreme example of that. So that's why I want to end with that line. I do.
And so we will.
Yeah.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
So tomorrow, 4 o'clock, is that right?
4 o'clock. So where do you guys stay?
We are at the Morris.
Morris. Okay, so they're right over here.
Yeah. Hi, Sean.
Sean,
yeah, we
how
met.
Are
yeah,
you?
Yeah,
yes, we met in New York.
Yeah. Very fine. Thanks for being here. Thanks for this. I think this chat was great.
Great, yeah.
Hey, Sean.
Sean and Leah Bertucci are showing program
the venue.
Yeah, that's great.
Oh, mine too. And my blue.
So the idea is come if you want to. But if you want to, like, if you're allowed, that's
moving
on. Okay, so it's just, it's a sort of a special meeting of sort of the class. This is the Boston film class. We're looking at, we've seen 4 movies so far. So we see the Jarmusch vampire truck flick.
Oh, I love that movie. Yeah. The Last People Left Alive.
Only Love Is Left Alive, right. Modern Age.
Good.
What
told you
so far?
Told you that.
So what were they doing that he thought was so cool?
So we see a bunch of movies, but we're actually operating from
where he said you can do.
Yeah.
He gave them the freedom to make sounds that they wanted to make.
Okay.
And they were embarrassed by
so one of the sort of
so they would goof on the piece and make, as he says, sounds that were not
what we
read characterized for the most part by their intention.